Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast full of energy. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, I'm a partner and propagandist Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
Also with us is founding editor, CEO and managing director of Shazarity.com, Shaz Rahman. Hello Shaz.
I've gained some lovely new titles which are self-appointed since my last guest on here.
Everyone gets 15 minutes of fame. Shaz is here to talk about the UK energy market, which is in a little bit of trouble.
That's an understatement.
Spoilers. So we'll start with three different news stories that I googled about 5 minutes ago. So one of them is from August 2019 from The Guardian, which talks about how thousands of homes might lose their energy supplies because of a financial shock to small energy companies. The second one is from October 2019, talking about how the profits of the big six energy companies fell 35%. So went from total profits of 924 million to 599 million. They've lost 1.3 million customers and used to serve 75% of UK customers. That's now down to just over 70%. And the third one is from February 2020. And Centrica, which is the company, as you know, Steve, owns British Gas. They made an £849 million loss in 2019 compared to £987 million profit in 2018, which is a turnaround of quite spectacular proportions, which led to their share price dropping by 15%. Shaz, why are there a trickle of stories like this appearing in the press at regular intervals about the UK energy market?
It's basically because the energy market, domestic as in gas and electric customers, is in free fall and nobody's really talking about it. There are several reasons, but the most dramatic reason is the standard price cap that's come in. So one of the interesting points that won't be reflected in those figures is that the price cap came in January 2019. And so we won't actually know the full ramifications for that, 6 months? When Companies House has all of the details of these big companies and how their business models, how they've coped with basically going from hundreds of millions of pounds of almost easy money to negative money.
So the price cap's interesting, isn't it? So it was Ed Miliband. Do you remember Ed Miliband?
I do remember Ed Miliband. Yeah. He of the bacon sandwich.
Yeah, well, before he was famous for eating a bacon sandwich, he was famous for this being his signature policy.
Yeah, a signature policy which the Tories ruthlessly attacked and said was completely unworkable and then introduced.
Well, that was the proper red Ed Miliband, wasn't it? This was seen as Marxist.
Until a Tory does it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, heaven forfend, the Labour Party bring forward policy that's... Oh, never mind. And then Theresa May, in a bid to, I suppose, it's that kind of Nick Timothy Erlington conservatism, isn't it? So try and help working class families, brings it in at the start of January 2019.
And there are legitimate reasons as a public policy for it. So fuel poverty has massively, massively increased over the last 10 years. And so the media portrayal of that has been very damaging to various governments, not just Conservative. You know, New Labour wasn't seen as very good on it either. And so there was lots and lots of public pressure to do something, you know, reduce bills. But the energy companies have been forced to take on several policy burdens. So things like ECO, which is funding for vulnerable customers mostly to do things like insulate their homes, give boilers to people who have, say, who are maybe on like old oil systems that are on the grid, try and give them mains gas, that kind of stuff. And also things like smart meters. So smart meters are meant to help with our energy infrastructure. It will mean loss of at the moment, we have problems like, I think still a majority of people estimate their bills. What will happen is you'll get a bill every 6 months and then you pay it, whereas you have no idea actually what you're using, and the energy company doesn't either. So smart meters and these kind of policy decisions have been force onto the energy companies without any subsidy in a practical sense in a lot of the cases. And so what's happened is, especially with smart meters, is that the price has been integrated into bills further, rising bill, so which basically increases bills further. So the energy companies are facing a pressure externally from government policy. They also have a bad public image, rightly or wrongly, mostly rightly, let's be fair, for not listening to customers, you know, having customers who are on the same tariff for 10 years and not letting them know of any better deals. So the government has been under massive, massive pressure to do something, anything, and what they've done has created a new set of problems.
Part of it was about trying to make it easier for people to switch energy supply as well, wasn't it?
Which is incredibly easy for most people. So if you're on a direct debit, then it takes 5 minutes online. But if you've got a prepayment meter and you're in £500 worth of debt, then it's very difficult. And obviously, if you're a low-income person, you're more likely to be on a prepayment meter. Therefore, you pay more per unit than you would if you're on a, you know, nice house that has direct debit, goes out monthly online.
I suppose, and one of the reasons why this fuel cap was brought in is because of the issue of fuel poverty.
Yeah, millions of people.
It's something, I think the figure is something like 10% at the moment. It's, again, the latest figures are
a couple of years old at this point, really.
Yeah, exactly. So, as you were saying before, we don't know quite what the impact of the price cap's been on fuel poverty. But it's about 10-11% of the population in fuel poverty. And as tends to be, those people who are poorest tend to be living in homes which aren't insulated or aren't very energy efficient, which means they use more energy anyway, and their bills are higher as a consequence.
And it's a higher percentage of their income, which is the important thing, which is what the fuel poverty definition includes.
There's a bit of a double whammy for energy companies, isn't there? So they had the extra policy changes like smart meters, which, as far as I can see, don't really seem to have any impact at all.
There can be good things.
Okay.
If the first generation were a bit dodgy in the sense that if you were with British Gas, you had a British Gas smart meter installed and you moved to Empower, you lose your smart meter functionality. But if you get a smart meter too, you keep that. And in terms of updated web infrastructure, they are incredibly important.
Smart meter too. Yeah. This time is personal.
Yeah.
But then the other thing as well, the impact on energy companies is that the price cap means they're not able to top slice profits, essentially.
Yes. So the big six that have a majority of people who wouldn't switch, would just be on their tariff for year after year. And that's where the massive profit margins for the big six were. That's why that British Gas figure. There are other factors at play. I think falling oil prices were part of that. But
falling gas prices as well. Yes,
yeah. But they could basically have a set of customers who wouldn't move, would maybe complain about it, but not actually do anything practically. And they could just sit on that year after year and then not innovate or not do anything about it. And then they would just count the money. But now the price cap has come in. This is speculation now. I'm not in a position to know this.
Speculate away.
But I don't think any of them actually thought it was going to happen. Or at least happen in the way it did. Because now, most of the big six, if you're bringing in a new customer, the profit margins on them will be hundreds of percents worse. There may not even be a profit margin on new customers. Empower, for example, lost £70 million last year because it couldn't bill its customers properly. And Steve's had personal experience of Empower's billing capabilities. And
they are the devil incarnate.
Yes, yeah. And so even if you do have 3 million, 5 million people who aren't going to move, who will just complain about you but not do anything about it.
If you can't bill them, you're not going to get your money.
If you don't have your own infrastructure in order, and this comes in as well and actually makes you look at your business model and try and see whether it's viable or not, then the energy company just weren't ready for it.
So is that down to a certain amount of complacency? I mean, my hunch would be that maybe they campaigned probably quite heavily against Labour because of Red Ed's Marxist policy, and then were quite
caught off guard, say, when Theresa May brings it in.
Yeah.
So there have been some innovations. So, for example, with British Gas and Empower, they're now moving to solutions-based economic models. So rather than And some of these have been doing these for years, but now they've become front and centre of their businesses rather than just a thing we do that's nice on the side,
mm-hmm.
is that I see your house is cold and your boiler needs replacing. We can give you an interest-free loan for so many years, or we know that your house is a solid brick house and needs insulating. We can do that for you over a 10-year loan, or you could basically become like the energy partner of customers rather than just selling you gas electric. So, you know, maybe they'll bring some scaffolding 1 week, do external wall insulation, next week put some solar panels on, then the week after, after you put your inverter in, make sure loft insulation's mm-hmm. topped up nicely. So rather than just say, you know, having a passive relationship with their customers, now the big six, or what the remnants of the big six are, and the smaller players who are doing well, they are now trying to change that relationship. So you've got a big database of people as a customer base. They may not be profitable in themselves as a list with your gas electric, but if I can sell you a boiler that's $4,000, and then I give you the service package as part of that price, and then, you know, then if something goes wrong, I come in and I install a smart thermostat and the other stuff. You then
thermostats now.
Yes.
Everything.
So you can try your heating from Devon, that kind of stuff. You know, yeah, you live in Newcastle, but actually, my app means I can control my heating. Also in Norway.
Yeah.
Don't tell Iowa a Democratic Party.
That change into a kind of, in effect, a bit more of a kind of a service model, which is based around kind of land and expand, is like absolutely fascinating from a business. What?
Land and expand.
That's the term in the
industry. Sounds like something Hernando Cortez would say.
Yeah, I know. That kind of land and expand approach is, in a lot of ways, it's a sign that they have woken up that they need to change their business models in order to stay viable. But again, I think the fact that they're only just doing this, I think, does very much speak to the complacency that that was mentioned earlier. I don't necessarily think it was just a case of we don't expect the Tories to ever bring in this specific price cap, because I think as an industry, and certainly for the big six, they've never been very responsive to any real kind of external kind of like pressures, unless it does boil down to like the force of regulation.
Well, it's been a bit of a problem with privatised industry and deregulated industry generally, hasn't it? So we've seen it in the transport area, for example, where the railways got privatised in the mid-90s, but it's not like lots of infrastructure investment happened in the railways. That's why you had things like the Hatfield crash. You know, I mean, what's the most innovative thing that's happened on the railways in the past 15 years? It's probably the Virgin Pendolino. Like, the sandwiches have improved, but not much else. And that's what it feels like with the energy market is. It was privatised, it was deregulated, it was said that I would set the customer free. People would be free to roam around, but that's not necessarily how it's happened in practice.
And a similar kind of thing also in when it comes to like the water companies as well, where again, pretty much every year, at least once a year, you'll probably find kind of like complaints about the amount of water that's being wasted from like leaks in pipes and all of that, prices being too high as a result, and all of those sorts of things.
Always a steady drip of news.
Oh, that's terrible.
He's very proud of himself.
He really is. Like, you can't see his grin reader as a listener, but
grin reader.
Yeah.
Lower pun happened, and his name was Death.
A Patreon benefit you could offer is live streaming of these things, so you could see how smug Corey is in the future. But yeah, one final point on water, in that companies want you to get a water meter, not because it will necessarily save them water in the short term. But they take gambles. So, for example, I live on my own and I pay an average price. And so I'm a small user of water, but if a four-person family moves in afterwards, there'll be a larger family, and so they can actually build properly. And then you can have your infrastructure improved past your front door, so you actually know what you're using and there are less leaks in the pipes. That's one of the massive problems, is that there may be water going in the pipes, but a lot of it isn't actually getting to your house.
Yeah. From kind of like newspaper headline kind of levels, like the big six in the energy market get a lot of focus. Like, some of the things that they are facing are not just limited to the energy sector, but an awful lot of their problems are still either of their own making or very specific as well.
Yeah. So there are two big exceptions to this, and they are Ecotricity and Good Energy. And they're the two like eco green companies that have been around for a long time. They're both exempt from the price cap because they're able to demonstrate that they've been able to invest so much back into the like things like supporting renewable players. So for example, if you had solar panels installed and then Ecotricity were the partner who were the ones who would administer taking that energy from your house, putting that back into the grid, or things like even just building their own wind turbines, and Good Energy have partnerships with small renewable energy providers all across the country. And so they're exempt. And so whilst there's been catastrophe across the sector, those two have remained untouched almost, partly because most people who were with them before, like been with them for 5 years, have been the early adopters who believed in renewable energy before it became cool. So they've been there because they're happy to pay a premium because they believe in what the product is. Whereas with the price cap, any company doesn't really matter if it's renewable or not. The profit margin just isn't there anymore.
That we've talked a bit then about why the big six are so affected. Is there anything particular affecting the smaller energy companies? Because I suppose one would think, looking at it from the outside, thinking generally that smaller companies might be a bit more nimble, might be able to maybe innovate their way out of it in a way that, say, a big multinational company isn't able to do. Are the smaller energy companies finding it easier or harder?
Well, they're finding it easier to go bust.
Okay.
So I think the last 3 years, at least 20 to 30 have gone bust for the likes of GB Energy UK, Breeze Energy. The list goes on and on. So
Breeze Energy?
Yeah, Breeze Energy, that was a thing.
They deserve to go bust because of the name.
I've never heard of any of these.
Well, that's one of the point. They may have 50,000 customers. They're the kind of companies that say, you know, next week Corey thinks, I'm going to switch after 4 years. I'm definitely going to do it this week. Goes on to U-Switch or whoever, and then goes, ah, this is the cheapest this week. And then next week they won't be the cheapest. And 6 months later they've gone bust.
So what happens if you are signed up to an energy company that goes bust?
So what will happen is, in theory, there's a bidding process from the other energy companies that still exist, and then they will take the customers of that bust company. So one of the problems for the new company is that they'll have to accept the terms and conditions of the old contracts. So, for example, if Corey, who hasn't switched in 4 years but then did switch, has a massive £1,000 credit, and then the bus company owes him lots of money, the new company has to accept that, and therefore that customer is very difficult to make a profit from.
Ooh.
For the short term. One of the problems within the smaller players is they may be very agile, they may have less back office staff, they may have smaller offices, they won't have big pension deficits. That's one of the big differences, that the big six will all have big pension deficits and will all have problems, like, you know, the Bergensey Council will. Every major provider that's been around for a long time
has.
You
just had to put the boot in, didn't you?
Yeah, yes, yeah. And so...
Local Birmingham reference, klaxon.
And so,
just Google it, listeners. I'm too depressed to talk about it now.
And so the smaller companies are more agile and can act quickly, but the business model tends to look like this instead. So they'll get new customers, they'll get 50,000, 100,000, 200,000, and they'll have a database of customers, and then they'll either try and sell the business on. So for example, First Utility became Shell Energy, and Shell, well, I mean, does it matter to Shell if they lose 10 million a year on this? Probably not. Whereas if you're Breeze Energy, you were building a database in the hope of either selling up or trying to make this profitable in the future. Bulb grew massively over the past year. They said they're providing 100% renewable electricity, but made £20 million loss. And they're one of the really big growth area, one of the big growth players. They can do this partly because they're backed by a much bigger consortium. Bulb Investments is massive. It's got a massive property portfolio, renewable energy provider for like owning solar panels and infrastructure. So they can afford to take a hit for 3 years, 5 years. And then maybe they're trying to figure out a way to make money out of it in that time. Maybe they just want to sell it on again. It's really hard to know. But it doesn't really matter how big you are, how small you are. With a few important exceptions, it is very, very difficult to make money out of the energy market at the moment, whilst we haven't actually, by the looks of it, made many more people removed from fuel poverty.
So is that the same in other European countries? Because obviously these are big six companies trading all across Europe, all across the world. Is Britain a special case?
So the most famous example is Germany. Germany has its own problems. So, for example, it's got its Energiewende, which basically means energy transition, roughly. And has massively invested in districts energy, massively invested in small-scale solar, lots of partnerships with local authorities and small communities. It's a massive growth area. The problem is that after Fukushima, they turned nuclear off almost overnight. Not literally, but it's been phased out in the 5 years since. And some of these big six providers owned nuclear plants, and one of them successfully sued the German government over it. And so what's happened is, to fill this almost black hole of nuclear, they've just gone and burnt a whole load of new coal. And it's lignite, it's the really, really bad coal. It's the stuff you don't want to be burning. And it has massive environmental impact as well. And so, whilst there is popular support for the Energiewende in Germany because they're willing to accept high prices, I don't think anybody has the solutions. Like, as with most things, Scandinavia probably has some of the best things. It's got, you know, passive houses. Sweden doesn't probably have mains gas, so they've got lots of other weird and wacky stuff going on. I say this, Norway's one of the biggest producers of oil in the world, isn't it?
Which
is how they're able to afford a lot of this sort of stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And I suppose there's a bit of a debate in Norway at the moment, isn't there, about that sovereign wealth fund trying not to invest in oil and move more green, which is hilarious, I suppose, when one thinks about it. Yeah. Hmm. What happened to our sovereign wealth fund that we built up because of
North Sea oil?
Never mind.
I think it went on to council tax cuts.
Well, indeed. Thanks, Margaret Thatcher. So, solutions then, that we just thinking about the direction the Labour Party is taking at the moment, but the leadership election as well. A lot of those candidates, almost all of them, in fact, talking about the idea of a Green New Deal or a Green Industrial Revolution, and presumably trying to have a sustainable energy market that used energy sources that aren't going to burn us all is part of that conversation.
Yeah, I imagine it is, but well, it definitely is.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm hedging that.
Either we burn or we don't.
Yeah.
I'd rather not burn.
Yeah, it definitely is a part of the part of the conversation and the solution. But I think more broadly, you've got I think this goes for a lot of issues on the left. There seems to be kind of a bit of a focus on trying to find almost like a one size fits all type thing, you know, one policy or something which can actively kind of like just solve all of the problems within that sector, within that area. When I think, especially when it comes to the energy markets, it's not going to be one size fits all. It's going to be lots of little things on new build areas that we were discussing before we started recording, like district energy heating and things like that, is actually going to be a very important part of that. But you can't necessarily put that into areas which don't already have them without massively digging up the entire area and connecting up all of the houses to it, which would cost probably billions upon billions upon billions to do that to every house in the UK. So you've got one area like district heating that needs to be looked at, but you've then also got the problem of like other types of houses which need to kind of still see get their heating from somewhere else. Like, we're reliant on gas for that at the moment. So is there a way we can look to turn that into electricity? That's a different kind of policy agenda. It's a different kind of area in and of itself, you know. It's going to have to be lots of individual smaller policies which build up into that Green Deal and that green revolution that the left is big on kind of like talking about. But I don't necessarily think, broadly speaking, at least in the UK, we're kind of doing enough, at least not shouting about it enough in the right kind of way.
Yeah, so a couple of the policy things I talked about earlier. So moving smart meters into general taxation, moving the eco funding into general taxation, putting it maybe as part of this Green New Deal. At the moment, the poorest people in our society pay the largest percentage of their bills, of their money on bills, and so it's a regressive way it's been funded. If you move these kind of funding pots into a more progressive taxation system, then that's one way to help. But yeah, at the moment we have lots more, we have lots more questions than we do answers. So, you know, things like electric charging points at the moment, it's up for grabs. We've got some on our motorway network and a few dotted around randomly that, like, Peterborough Council put in, for example, because I saw one.
Northfield High Street, randomly.
Yeah, and, you know, but we need to redesign our cities, and so charging points will become the norm, and that infrastructure's up for grabs. The companies trying to get into that space. Government policy will dictate whether these things take off or not. They have to happen sooner or later, but at the moment it's kind of 2035, 2050. Lots of things are being phased out slowly rather than having investment directly put into them now.
I suppose there's two things, aren't there? One of them is it's that radical need to reshape our cities and towns.
Yes, becoming less car reliant.
Which, in a sense, needs to be a top-down process. But then on the flip side of that, it's also a massive kind of decentralisation. And part of the Green New Deal that's part of the Labour manifesto was basically providing massive pots of money that local people, small businesses, local councils would apply for to try and revolutionise green thinking in their areas. Even if that was to happen, that would be huge and expensive and long and hard. But I suppose the other wider point maybe of talking about a Green New Deal is, and this is the point that Lisa Nandy's made, is it doesn't really mean much to people in Britain, because I don't think many people know the ins and outs of Franklin Roosevelt's administration. I mean,
he did amazing things with cooperatives and energy infrastructure.
He probably did, but I don't know if necessarily that electricity point in Northfield High Street knows about FDR. I've seen some talk about it more in terms of a green industrial revolution, which I suppose is more British and talks that fits into that area.
I mean, I think what you're talking about there kind of falls into partially like the comms around this sort of stuff and how we talk about it. But I think maybe if we're looking at that, then we need to almost look at how, kind of like, go back to how, before we had a Big Six, you know, how was an awful lot of our kind of like energy needs kind of like organised? Well, a lot of it was regional. You did have things like, again, obscure Birmingham references, like the Midlands Gas Board and things like that.
Yeah, which were Midlands Energy Board.
Yeah, sorry, Midlands Energy Board, which was effectively nationalised by Thatcher, I think, and then sold, privatised.
No, it wasn't nationalised by Thatcher.
Yeah. Thatcher sold it off.
Yeah. Thatcher wasn't downward nationalising.
Yeah. But
yeah. It's a good point, though.
But like, in effect, they had to take control of it to sell it off, you know, in some form. But yeah, and so basically a load of like regional infrastructure was in place for kind of like running a lot of energy stuff and gas and electricity, and then was gone as part of the privatisation push during the 1980s and I think early 90s. There are a lot of people who will remember that, remember those kind of things existing. So maybe from a policy kind of agenda, tapping into things that, you know, this isn't radical. This used to be how we did things.
Shouldn't be tapping into gas, surely.
You know what I mean.
Health and safety nightmare.
It's a lot easier for us to make the case for things that already existed than to kind of try and talk to a vision for the future, you know, in a very kind of like symbolic way. When if we can just go, actually, no, like, just talk to your uncle will remember this, you know, that kind of thing.
And also, there are exciting opportunities in all of this. So, you know, how many new jobs could be created that actually are well paid, potentially unionised, actually have pensions, that kind of stuff, that are skilled, and the amount of upskilling you could do. So, you know, a builder could retrain as a solar panel installer. You know, a builder could retrain to build passive standard houses. Like, there are lots of opportunities. I mean, it's going to be incredibly expensive. I mean, there's no way around it if it's done. But there are incredible upskilling opportunities. And with that, 10, 20 years, if these things are happen, you would just have a nicer, you'd have a nice house to live in. You'd have a better atmosphere, and then the roads will be nicer. You'd have all this stuff that, even if you didn't believe in climate change or, you know, climate emergency, it'll be better for you anyway.
That's a hopeful note on which to end on. It's not necessarily an emergency, Steve, but you could support us on Patreon, couldn't you?
You could indeed. Yeah, you can head over to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, throw us a few quid every month, and you'll get access to unique content, early access to content that goes out.
Live streams of Corey.
Grinning like a madman as he makes terrible puns.
It's the only reason you've paid money, listeners. You know,
and there's kind of been some debates on some of the articles that have gone up as well. So it's a nice place to be, and you should check it out.
And,
what's the name of the page?
Patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. Okay. I did mention that.
Did you?
Yeah, right at the beginning.
Okay, sorry.
But leave it in anyway. If you do decide to back us, listeners, or if you are one of the people who already are, essentially what you're allowing us to do is to continue doing this, because you know, there are always costs associated with these sorts of little projects, and you know, we want to get into a position where all our costs are covered. You know, we're able to invest in some nicer, newer equipment. So rather than having three people kind of staring into a single mic, we can get some fancier electronics set up to make everything work, sound clearer, you know, all that kind of stuff.
We have a website as well, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Deppert Dave Deppert composed our theme tune. Looking good times. Shaz, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yes, I recently launched a website called Shazietycom where I talk about environmental campaigning and society and other things I like death metal.
And what is? How do you spell Shaziety?
Shaz, S-H-A-Z, then I-E-T-Y, then .com.
I'm @PaperbackWriter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
@Shaz130.
Happy plotting.